Now, this morning we've been hearing from the first ever winner of Britain's Got Talent, Paul Potts. His life before he entered the show has been made into a movie. His autobiography is out this week and he has some remarkable stories to tell. Look, this isn't a celebrity interview. I couldn't care less, to be honest with you, about a lot of his celebrity world. I care about the man that he has become because of what has happened in the past. And it's really, really fascinating, I reckon, to hear how someone is messed up because of how others treat him during his formative years. So we'll pick up the interview again. We'll start now with him when he tells us about what it was like walking out onto that audition stage to face Simon Cowell for the panel for the first time.
It was Simon Cowell, Piers Morgan and Amanda Holden.
What were you like inside your head?
Well, basically, I'd seen and heard the previous act, and it was... It was a man from Bristol that was whistling birdsong, and his wife was dancing with a pashmina scarf to his birdsong, and they got booed off very quickly. And at this point, I was kind of shaking my head in my hands, thinking, "What the hell are you doing here? Why don't you just go? You know, you don't want to have that kind of reaction."
Did you nearly walk away?
I didn't really get the opportunity to, because one of the stage managers came over and said, "Right, are you okay?" And then I said, well, I'd be happy if I could use a backing track, because it wasn't clear to us at that point whether we'd be allowed to use one or not. And I was fearing having to sing a cappella, you know, without any kind of accompaniment, and that made me feel even more nervous. And when I did eventually walk out onto the stage, my legs were shaking. I was very conscious of the fact that I was wearing a jacket that wasn't the best fit on me. It was too long on the arms, and except that I wouldn't have a hope in hell of actually doing the jacket up, because it wasn't big enough across the chest. And I just kind of shuffled on awkwardly, something which Simon later commented on. And, you know, I wondered whether I belonged on the stage at all. And it wasn't until the music started that I settled.
Can you describe the feeling inside yourself when that music started? That feeling of contentment?
It's really just like I go to a different place, and it's always felt like this. It's always been like a key opening a door, and it lets me into a world where I've always felt that I belonged. Outside of that world, I didn't belong anywhere. I didn't belong in around people. I stood on stage singing. Once music starts, it is like just being in this private world. I actually felt that I'd blown it.
Blown it? You were getting a standing ovation.
So you work at Carphone Warehouse... And you did that. I wasn't expecting that.
No, neither was I.
This was a complete breath of fresh air. I thought you were absolutely fantastic.
I was blown away by the reaction, but I felt I'd blown it, because the top B had way too much tension in it, and it's always been a technical problem that I've struggled with, is just controlling tension and the notes split. And it being that crucial top B, I thought, well, you know, everybody knows this aria, and it's often described as an advantage to pick something that's really well known, but it's also a risk, because, you know, people know it and they know what to expect, and they're expecting certain things and certain parts of it, and everybody expects that top B to be big and powerful. And to me, it just felt like there was a lot of tension, and it was a little harsh, and I didn't think it was good enough. And I do tend to be my harshest critic. Yeah. And
because that's how you had been groomed to think, from all that bullying over all of those years, nothing you would do would ever make you good enough. You didn't have the potential to be good, is what you were taught from an early... I'm really angry, actually, on your behalf, Paul. I really am. You win the whole contest and your life is changing, presumably really, really fast. You've won Britain's Got Talent. That must have been amazing, that roller coaster ride.
It was. I mean, I couldn't quite believe it. I mean, I I did actually swear into my hands. Thankfully, my mic didn't pick it up. But I'd gone through each stage, just taking it every day as it came. And there were some ways where the things I struggled with in early life did actually help me deal with what happened when things go well, because I think you've got to treat life the same. And I just got through each day, between, you know, especially between the ages of 15 and 17, where basically everywhere I wasn't just being told that I was nothing. It was being demonstrated to me that I was nothing, because I suffered at that point in my life. I suffered physical and physical abuse from people in school, and when I went to a sea cadet corps, I was then sexually abused by one of the leaders, and it was just always demonstrated to me that I wasn't, you know, I kind of felt like I wasn't a person. So I had to get from one day to the next, and then from the next day to the next day, and I lived completely day to day. I didn't know what would happen, and so I just kind of got through each day. And how that helped me when things changed in June 2007 was that I kind of applied the same attitude, which was just to live each day as it came, not to second guess what happens, and to live each day and enjoy each one. Because I think that if you try and see too much into the future, I think you make assumptions. You can make assumptions that things are going to be bad, or you can make assumptions that things are going to be great. And, you know, if you listen too hard to people telling you how wonderful you are, I think you start believing your own hype. And I think that's really dangerous, because you end up with a very false opinion of who and what you are. And you have to remain true to yourself at all times, for good or for ill. You have to be true to yourself. Yeah, but Paul, I think otherwise you go crazy.
Yeah, but Paul, for a life of feeling bad about yourself, it would have been okay to feel good. It would have been okay to feel special, because you were special. You are special. You know, it would have been okay.
I'm just me, and I'm doing what I love, which makes me feel incredibly fortunate.
Did you ever get a chance to speak about the lack of self confidence, the lack of self esteem with Simon Cowell?
When Simon was speaking about the audition, he told me that I shuffled on like I was apologising for being there. So, and in some ways that was probably true, because, you know, I just felt that I didn't belong anywhere, and I've often felt that I don't deserve good things.
I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, after you won Britain's Got Talent, has Simon Cowell looked after you?
Simon is he's a very business minded person, but he does care about what happens. But I didn't open up to anybody about what I'd been through until much more recently. You know that old saying where you know, it's better to keep your mouth shut and have people think you're a fool than to open your mouth and confirm the fact. So I didn't really discuss things with anybody other than my wife, or very close friends.
You mentioned earlier on that you were sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
When you were in the Sea Cadets.
Yeah.
You were age 15, Paul, is that right?
15, yeah. It was between the age of 15 and about 17.
How did that man get access to you?
Well, I'd been on a trip to Weymouth, and it was part of my seamanship badge to get leading seaman, and I had to steer a boat and do observations, and there were certain things I had to do in order to qualify for the higher rank. And there were a number of other boys on the ship as well. It was quite a small ship, but this particular guy would always sat opposite my bunk pretty much every morning. And he asked me to stay on when we came back to Bristol. He asked me to stay on to help clean up, and that's how he got access. And because of everything that was happening at school, I just got into a mentality that I really didn't matter, and whatever people did to me didn't matter either, because, you know, I got so far down that line that I, you know, I felt I was of no consequence. Anything that anybody did, you know, I just let them do. And of course that just pushed my self-esteem lower and lower. And, you know, the thought of telling anyone for me just was, if I told people, it would show them how little value I had. And so I just acted like it wasn't going on, and it was part of my coping mechanism was to compartmentalize everything, put things into certain containers. And
one of the days he abused you was the same day that the bullies at school had tried to throw you through a window.
Yeah. So it made bullying at school made me much more vulnerable to other things, because it, you know, when you're bullied daily, when you're bullied occasionally, which a lot of children do get bullied, you know, bullying isn't unusual at school. It's when it's consistent and sustained.
And he abused you for about 2 years, is that right?
Yeah, on and off for 2 years. I couldn't say exactly how many times or exactly when, but it was something that was, you know, there was always that undercurrent, and he'd find an excuse to have me sent to the stores, and there he would touch me and kiss me. But I mean, I didn't want any of that attention, you know, but I had no way of expressing that, and because I, you know, I'd had a full day of having stuff thrown at me all the time, and things being shouted at me, and, you know, that message was always being reinforced that I was worthless, that I was nothing, and to me, you know, anything that happened to me meant that I was of no consequence whatsoever. So, you know, as much as I wanted to shout and scream, it just felt like no sound could come out. I just had no way of expressing it.
We've heard a lot over the last year, post-Savile, of sexual abuse and the impact on victims. Can you put words to describe the impact sexual abuse had on you?
It made me feel powerless, even though physical force was used. It made me feel powerless, because abuse is never ever about sexual gratification. It's not to do with being turned on. It's about power, and it's about one person having power over another person. And if you're disempowered, then you're more likely to be abused, because you're easy to overpower. And so the weaker, somebody that's weaker, and I describe abusers generally as being not just morally, but I think they are actually weaker people, because they tend to look for the weaker people, because they can overpower them. That gives them some kind of kick. But the impact it has on you being the person being abused, it just makes you feel like you're not just no one, you're nothing, you're not anything, and so you become more and more vulnerable to it, and you become less and less likely to talk about it.
Have you can you still feel the consequences of that abuse to this day?
I don't think it will ever leave. Because I think it's not just about what you go through in life when you're very young that has an impression, and it was just everything at the same time. I think the bullying, the abuse, it was just because it was all happening at the same time. I mean, I had to compartmentalize it. I had no other way of dealing with it. And you know, and I think part of the problem with me is that I'm not stupid. I'm very articulate, and I am quite intelligent, and I struggle to deal with it, literally, because I try and rationalize it, And that's my way of trying to deal with it in my head, is to try and rationalise it. The only trouble is, of course, is that you can't rationalise something like this. It's not something you can rationalise, but in my head, I struggle with that. I have to find a reason, and often there is no reason, but I just keep asking for that reason. That will never be found.
Isn't it incredible, Paul, that given what you endured in life, given the terrible deck of cards that you were given, that you have become a worldwide performer? Concerts around the world, one of the most viewed performers on YouTube ever, appeared on Oprah Winfrey. What an incredible experiences, because you were worth it, because you had every right to be there. They wanted you. So this kid that was isolated, nobody wanted, is now being affirmed as a star. And that's you.
I do wonder really whether it's something that I deserve. And I think I'll always struggle with that. And I think I'll always struggle with insecurity. But I think sometimes you have to find different ways of looking at things. And my way of looking at insecurity is that it's, as long as you don't allow it to control who you are, it can help you become a better person, because and it can make you better at what you do, because you're always chasing yourself to improve at certain things.
Tell me about some of the big, big gigs you've done. Just list them off.
I've done nearly 500 shows in the last 5 years, so it's been quite intense. But I've done about 6 different concerts at the Royal Albert Hall. I've performed at the Sydney Opera House, which is an amazing gig to play. And I actually climbed the Sydney Harbour Bridge about an hour before I was due on stage. I'm not scared of heights at all, so that's no problem there. I also performed to see in the new year at Brandenburg Gates in 2011, in front of something like 1.5 million people, which was just bizarre. There were just people all around for as far as I could see. I just find it incredible that, you know, I'm still doing what I love doing 6 years on. I'm very fortunate to do what I love and to have it as a career. And I've played in so many different countries and had huge crowds, thousands and thousands of people come to watch me. It's just, to me, it's just really bizarre. I'm just not always sure I deserve it. But it's why, Paul,
I know the gigs you've done. It's why I've asked you to say out loud what gigs you have done. It's why I'm asking you to do it. Because surely at some stage in your head, you know, when you list off those gigs in front of 1 million people and, you know, it's 100 million YouTube hits. It's actually over 100 million YouTube hits. So people, you know, not being forced to download what you do, but wanting to, that's surely, you say you're an intelligent person. Surely there's part of your brain understanding that you're worth it, understanding that you deserve it, because there's nobody making it happen but you. And your story for me, I don't know how other people will interpret it, but your story for me is a huge shining light on what bullying and abuse actually does to a human being. Because you still don't think you deserve it. You still don't think you've got self-worth. And you're an incredibly talented guy, aren't you?
I just chuckle at that. I kind of struggle to accept it. I am in a better place than I was, and I'll always have to constantly work at my confidence, because it's always something that nags somewhere in the background.
Are you enjoying life now?
Yeah, I love what I do, and I When I do have a few spare moments, I do a lot of walking, which I find is really good. I think it's really good for the soul, because I love walking in different places I go to. I mean, I've been to 45 different countries, so I've seen a lot of the world, and I like to just sort of escape and just wander sometimes just by myself, sometimes with a bit of music on earphones, or going around with a camera and taking photographs, just getting, you know, a few snapshots of life and just taking it all in, really. And
now your life story is being made into a film. James Corden starring as you.
Yeah, it was kind of weird watching that, but I love the film, and I love what they've done with it, because I always wanted it to be a comedy, because I think the message, and the message is the same in the book as it is in the film, and that is
your autobiography called One Chance.
Yeah, the message is the same, really. It's you know, no matter what you go through in life, if you get to where you want to go by keeping going. People will throw things at you. People will stand in your way, but you just keep going, and you do that. And it's not, you don't do that just by yourself. You do that in spite of yourself sometimes, and you do it because of the people around you that mean things to you. And often with one particular person that just sits by you, holding your hand, and just telling you that it's okay, and that you can do things, even if you in your head are telling yourself you can't. It's about really just getting to your destination just by keeping going. And both the film and the book give that message. But of course, in the film, it's slightly different because you don't have as much time. And also, I wanted the film to be a comedy because I felt that the message would actually get through much easier in 90 minutes when it's making people laugh and. It kind of goes in under the radar then, because I think if people feel like they're being taught something, I think they can switch it off.
I can't wait.
It doesn't have an impact.
I can't wait to see the film and indeed read the book. And you're authentic, Paul, and I've really enjoyed talking to you. And thank you for being so open about some of your life story, Paul. Thank you very, very much, sir.
Thank you.